Welcome to the Right Turn Radio Podcast. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean.
And you're listening to New England's foremost addiction and mental health program.
So I was getting $100 when I turned 16, working on the farm. And that was all right. I just got into drugs by then, so $100 probably could get me through the week. No, I couldn't stop at the store or get a bag of beef jerky and chips anymore, because now that $100 is donated to the pharmacies. So an OxyContin costs $100, so you get one. But at that point, I really didn't. It lasted a while because I was just fresh into it. Didn't need a lot to make me feel the way I like to feel.
The crazy thing about OxyContin is really quick, your body gets used to that amount that you're doing.
The first month, I could do just a little chunk of it, and I don't know how many grams, maybe 10, 15, 20 milligrams would be, you know, set you in, and it lasts for half the day, maybe.
But eventually, when you take the same amount of something every single day, it's not going to do it anymore.
As time goes on, then you need more of it, because now 10, 15 milligrams ain't enough, and it don't last as long because your body's kind of taking in, getting immune to it.
So instead of doing a 40 milligram OxyContin, I needed to do an 80. And then I'd get high again. And then it'd take another month for that 80 milligram for me not to get high again.
Then it just goes on and on. And then by the time you get up to, you know, a little while into it, I don't know, but maybe 6 months into it, now I can do a whole 80 and it lasts a couple hours, 2-3 hours, and then the high's gone. You just spent $100, now you're broke. Now what am I gonna do?
Welcome to Right Turn Radio. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean. That was a clip from The Hungry Heart, a documentary film about opiate drug crisis in Vermont. Later tonight, the film's director and producer, Bess O'Brien, will join us on the show, and we encourage you to call in with questions or comments for Bess.
But first, Vermont has recently come face-to-face with what Governor Peter Shumlin calls a full-blown heroin crisis. Vermont had twice the number of deaths from heroin overdoses last year compared with the year before, and five times more federal indictments against heroin dealers than in 2010. It's estimated that more than $2 million worth of heroin and other opiates are being trafficked into Vermont each week. Earlier this month, in a bold move that garnered national attention, Governor Shumlin dedicated the entirety of his State of the State speech to substance abuse and addiction. Governor Shumlin joined us on the phone earlier to talk about the state of addiction and treatment in Vermont. Governor Shumlin, welcome to Right Turn Radio.
Hey, good to be on with you.
We in the field of addiction treatment know that opiates are a huge problem. But what made you sit up and take notice and make this the focus of your State of the State message?
Well, you know, Vermonters treasure our quality of life. I mean, Vermont is the best state in the nation to live in terms of community. We take care of each other. We reach out to neighbors. We reach out to strangers. And we know each other well. So when I travel around Vermont, which I do almost constantly, I just have too many Vermonters saying to me two things. Either I've got family members who are addicted and it's destroying our family and it's destroying us, or too many Vermonters who have lost the sense of security that their property is safe as folks who are suffering from this disease feed their habits by having to rob and steal to get their drugs.
Well, the traditional political reaction to this has been through the justice system, and I'm interested in understanding why you're advocating for something different.
Well, the justice system alone is not working for us, and, you know, the war on drugs has failed us. And so at some point, someone's got to stand up and say, well, so how can we do this better? Objectively, if we're willing to accept that this is a disease, that addiction is a disease, how can we treat it more like a disease and get better results? So this is what I found when I started really digging into it. And I've learned a bit about addiction. I'm certainly not an expert. But here in Vermont, what we found is two problems. One, we have hundreds and hundreds of folks who, you know, usually start out with OxyContin and FDA-approved drugs. Just remember that. That's nothing but heroin in pill form. Then, since OxyContin is now more expensive than heroin on the streets, they tend to move to the cheaper option, which is heroin, and they're full-blown addicted to a lifelong battle. we have hundreds of Vermonters who've hit the point where they say, I'm bottomed out, I want treatment, and we don't have treatment facilities available to them. So that's the first thing we need to fix. But the second piece is, when addicts are most likely to accept treatment and to move into treatment, to recognize they really have a problem that they got to deal with because they're destroying their lives, that moment with any addiction, you know, these folks are the best deniers and the best liars you'll ever meet. The moment of the crisis tends to be when you're most likely to get them into treatment. So yes, the blue lights are flashing, you bottomed out. Our judicial system works against that moment. It says, you've been bad, we're charging you. And then they often take months to wind the way through the court system before there's actually a decision made, usually a criminal sentence. So my point is, in Vermont, we want to change that system so that our prosecutors have the ability with a third-party analysis to say, this person's not going to kill you, they're not going to hurt you, they've got a disease, and move those folks directly into treatment if they'll go, monitor them very carefully, and if they succeed, never put them through the criminal justice system.
So striking while the iron is hot, so to speak, getting them into treatment as soon as possible. Can you give us kind of the boots on the ground plan for when somebody is at that point, how that would look?
Sure. So let's say that you just got busted. And, you know, all states, but certainly ours, does these, you know, we go in and with the feds and in our state and local law enforcement, we do busts. You'd immediately, you know, within hours, have third-party assessors there to figure out whether you're suffering from the disease or whether, you know, someone that we should be disappointed in, mad at perhaps, or whether you're someone we should be scared of. If you're someone we should be scared of, you're going through the criminal justice system. But the vast majority of folks are people who are addicted. They're suffering from a disease no different than cancer, kidney disease, or anything else. So that third-party assessor will give that prosecutor, in a sense, the objective analysis that they can rely upon to give them the confidence that they can offer them treatment, monitor that treatment in our local communities, lots of caregivers, as we would do with any healthcare crisis, and hopefully succeed in that recovery so that we help them to treat the disease as opposed to throwing them into the prison system, which frankly usually augments their disease, detract from it.
What's been the response from the judicial branch, from prosecutors and judges?
Well, they've been working together with us on these creative solutions. So, you know, I'm incredibly grateful to law enforcement, to our prosecutors, to our judicial system, to our treatment folks, healthcare folks. I mean, we're in this together in Vermont because we want to get this right. Listen, this is a battle that we're losing, not winning. And when you're losing something this badly, and by the way, Vermont is no different than anywhere else. It's just we're up here dealing with it. I mean, people often say, "Why Vermont?" And my answer is, "Why America?" I mean, this is a crisis that's affecting all of us. But we can't simply continue. I mean, let me just give you the numbers. First of all, you got to know that, as we all know, these folks who are addicted, they're our kids. They walk, they talk, they breathe, just like anyone else who's suffering from any other disease. In many cases, they're just as lovable as anybody else. So forget your heart for a minute and just do the math with me for a minute. In Vermont, about 80% of our folks in prison are there because of drug-related, addiction-related charges. So 80%. Now, it cost me $1,123 to put a Vermonter in prison for a week.
Mm.
I can, for $123, give extraordinary local community health care treatment for their disease. So think about the math. Now, my prison spending has doubled in the last 9 years, and Vermont's no different than the rest of the country. I'm spending more on prisons now than I am on higher education. But we continue to say, hey, let's just keep doing what we're doing. Let's fight drug addiction with law enforcement alone and not think more creatively about how we can get better outcomes, save taxpayers more money, and actually move folks who are suffering from a disease to a livable, productive, and hopeful life.
Governor Shumlin, I have to commend you for this is so forward-thinking. And it, you know, us in the field of treatment always hope for something like this for a politician, you know, and somebody in the government to really come out and say this is a problem. And I think talking about it as a fiscal issue is one of the best ways to make it relatable to the public. What about prevention and education? Is there a plan in Vermont for that?
There is. And, you know, one of the most frustrating parts for me about this conversation is, you know, I've just outlined what we can change in our judicial process once you're addicted. I've just outlined some of the things we can do to do treatment better once you're addicted. The models for prevention are, there is no model that makes you go nationally, wow, you know, these folks are really getting it right. So we're trying to invent those from scratch. But a few things. One is, we have a filmmaker here, Bess O'Brien, who has made an extraordinary film called The Hungry Heart, which really focuses on addiction in one little community here in Vermont. And it talks about the lives. It's really centered around a doctor, a family physician. I've been working in 43 years in this small community, and he started finding that, it, you know, his, as these kids grew up that he'd been treating all their lives, they became addicted. So here's a little doctor in a little town that had 80 addicts that he was treating by the time he retired from his practice. So she bases the film on that. It's a very moving and compelling story about what happens to you in addiction, how you get in, what the effects are, and what it does to your life. We're going to be showing that in every single school in Vermont. We're going to be making other efforts to help do education and prevention better. But really, the true prevention is jobs, education, and hope.
That's right. You know, you spoke from a political platform on your State of the State message. But on a personal level, what would you tell parents and family members of an addict?
You know, I would say, first of all, the biggest challenge we have with this disease is that no one wants to talk about it.
Yeah.
Governors, family members, addicts, relatives, it's a whisper world.
I call
it the great whisper world, the huge silence. We got to break the silence. This is no different than cancer, kidney disease, or the other diseases that your neighbors feel huge sympathy for. And so we got to change the dialogue there. And one reason I felt as a governor that it was important for me to speak out about this is because someone's got to break the silence, and we've got to work together, all of us, to do that. So if we accept that this is a disease and that it's no different than any other disease, although, frankly, it's a little more depressing because it's a relentless one, it's one that you'll struggle with all your life, the question for us all is, you know, how do we work together to engage communities, everyone in communities, to help us fight this disease and to do prevention better? And I say, you know, there are a lot of things we can do, but probably the biggest one is by understanding it, talking about it, acknowledging it, and all rolling up our sleeves and saying, we've got a role in ensuring that our kids and our neighbors understand what happens to you when you get addicted to opiates, because it's a brutal, unhappy, very, very destructive future. And think more creatively about ways that we can ensure that we say to the dealers, you know, it's not okay for you to be here preying on our people.
Right. Governor Shumlin, thank you for taking time out to talk to Right Turn Radio. It's an incredibly bold and forward-thinking move by bringing this to the light of the populace of Vermont, and hopefully talk to you soon. We'll check up with you in a little while and see how it's going.
Great. Well, we're looking forward to making progress. As you know, it's a tough one, but I'm convinced that Vermont can begin to get this right. Well, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. We'll be back with Bess O'Brien, director of The Hungry Heart, right after the break.
At my worst, I could spend, oh my God, I could spend $500 a day, easily.
For me, it was about $600 a week. No, $600 a day. I was doing about $680 a day.
My addiction was costing me $4,200 a week. Yeah.
Sometimes I was spending up to $10,000 a week or $3,000 a day on my habit.
Normal people wake up and they need to eat and they need to drink some water. You know, they need that food and water. Where I didn't need food and water. I needed OxyContin.
You know how you wake up in bed and you just think, oh, I gotta go get my coffee and I gotta get ready for work. Well, with drug addicts, they say, oh, where's my pill?
The first thing you think about, not like feeding your kids breakfast or, you know, whatever, was like how you're gonna get high and how you're gonna get money to get high and who you're gonna get it from. And it's a whole lifestyle.
And this is just to get me up and functioning. This isn't even, okay, I'm high now. This is just, I'm just getting up and giving my daughter some breakfast.
Welcome back. I'm Abby Dean, and I'm here with John Cohan. That was another clip from the film The Hungry Heart, which Governor Shumlin addressed in his State of the Union address. I mean, State of the State message. And we're lucky to have with us tonight the director, Bess O'Brien, and she's here with us now. Welcome, Bess.
Hi.
We thought we were all talking about this film and how amazing it was. What possessed you to make this film? It was really moving, really beautiful, and really, really honest.
Yeah. Well, I've been making documentary films up here in Vermont for about 20 years on many different issues, and I was actually finishing another film called Ask Us Who We Are, which was on foster care here in Vermont, and I got a call saying that there was this pediatrician up in St. Albans, Dr. Fred Holmes, who had been working with young people around opiate addiction, and he really wanted to create a project that focused on their voices and brought to life their stories, because in his work with them, he fell in love with these people. And
that was really obvious from the film, how much he really cared about them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And this is a guy who, you know, moved up to Vermont 35 years ago, was a pediatrician, a beloved pediatrician. Everybody knew him. He, like, knew every kid in the community, did house calls for years and years and years. And then about 7 years ago, one of his patients, who at that time was 16, walked into his office and said, "Doc, you got to help me because I'm addicted to pills and I don't know what to do." And Fred didn't know what to do either. And so the only thing that he could think about doing, because this is what doctors do to help opiates, was to get his license for Suboxone and start to work with the local social service outpatient organization, the Howard Center, to start treating these young people. And so he got his license and he started working with the Howard Center, and before you knew it, he had, you know, more up to 100 patients and a waiting list a mile long. And, you know, I think what happened is that over the years, over the last 7-8 years in Vermont, opiate addiction, especially around prescription drugs, has become a big, big deal. And St. Albans, where he was practicing, which is above Burlington in Vermont, was one of the hotbeds of prescription drug addiction. And so, you know, things started happening in that community. We were hearing a lot about it. But he was feeling like, even though there was a lot of attention put onto this issue, really the intimate human stories of these kids were not being told. And in fact, there was a certain amount of judgment and ridicule about these kids, as in the fact of, you know, well, that's just their problem. Those are those kids from that side of the track, or, you know, sort of all of the stigma that you find around addiction. And that was really bothering him. And so somebody said, well, you should talk to Bess O'Brien because she makes these movies where she sort of takes the invisible and makes it visible. And so he called me. I came up to St. Albans. We met about 4 or 5 times with community members, people in recovery, concerned citizens. I showed some of my other films. We talked about making a movie, and then we decided to do it, and the rest is history.
What's interesting about the film is that you kind of explode the idea of who an addict is, you know, the typical kind of addict, because there's people in your film from, you know, you start out with a young man raised on the farm. There's a very successful woman who worked in...
at Citibank.
Yeah, at Citibank. And so it kind of explodes that idea of, you know, the urban drug user. I just thought that was a kind of a wonderful way of showing how the disease of addiction attacks everybody at all different levels. We're going to listen to another clip from the movie right now.
We all have this idea about who a drug addict is and who an alcoholic is and what those people look like. And then, you know, we can point our finger at them.
It really doesn't matter what you look like. what side of the tracks you come from, it can happen to you, and it did.
I was successful, and you know, I had a beautiful business that people admired. We were doing well. I had a handsome and loving husband, and I had a beautiful son.
I started off making $18,000 a year, and I ended up making over $200,000 a year with City Financial. I mean, I had a great life. The two houses, the cars, four kids.
It can happen to anybody at any time, and I'm living proof of that. I was 30 years old before I became an opiate addict. That first time I took those Vicodin, it was like felt like a gift from God.
And oh my God, it was just, I don't know, like something had been set free.
I can say with absolute certainty that though I was not physically addicted, that first time I took those opiates, I was a goner.
And from there, it was on.
So I thought that was a wonderful description, Betts, about you know, who it affects. It's not who you think it is. Were you surprised at who was willing to be in this movie and who you found?
Not really. I mean, ironically, I made a film 12 years ago in Vermont called Here Today on Heroin Addiction.
So this is old hat.
Right, this is my second time around. And I live in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont, which is the other side of Vermont from St. Albans, in a very rural area. And I was asked to make a film about 12 years ago because that's when heroin first started to make a huge impact. And I focused. It was a different kind of film. It was a smaller movie, but it was a lovely little piece about a family struggling with heroin addiction. And we toured it all over Vermont, like we did with this. So. And since then, I've made a lot of other films. I mean, I think that with documentary film, when you start to talk to people about making a movie about their lives, and they say, yes, I'm ready to be in that movie, they are ready to talk.
Nice.
I have very rarely found in my films anybody who doesn't want to tell their story. And I think part of that is because, frankly, as a society, we don't really ask drug addicts or people in foster care or, you know, whatever issue you're focusing on about their lives.
I'm sorry, Bess, we have to take a break, but I thought you had wonderful access and it really, some of the interplay between the doctor and his patients was very, very powerful. We're going to take a break. You're listening to Bess O'Brien on Right Turn Radio. Bess, we talk about, in the movie, you talk about the family aspects of the disease and how it impacts the family. Why did you include that dynamic in the film?
Well, because as we all know, you know, addiction is not just about the person who's dealing with it. It affects the entire family, and frankly, it affects their friends and their community. But families go through hell. And, I mean, Dustin, who is the sort of the star of the film, there's many people in the movie, but he sort of is the quintessential Vermont kid.
Oh, yeah.
Grew up on a farm. Yeah, grew up on a farm, did great. But, you know, it was just amazing because I really wanted his mother to talk about what she went through with him, and she was willing to talk to me. And I think that one of the most powerful parts of the film is hearing both of their stories back to back, what he was going through, what she was going through, how his addiction, you know, tore the family apart, how he stole $25,000 worth of
tools
from
we actually have that clip, and I'd love to play it because I love the interplay between the two of them because it really, you know, panned back and forth. Can we do the clip?
When I first started noticing it with Dustin is family functions. We always do a lot with family, and he was never around. Always had some place to go or something to do.
I might stop into the family event for an hour just to say hi and show my face, then go hang out with my buddies and get high.
I couldn't keep him in the barn more than an hour at a time, and then he wasn't answering phones, and that's when I said to my husband, something's wrong. He sold his skidoo, he sold his bow. Just things that meant a lot to him meant absolutely nothing to him.
I started stealing whatever it took to get money. I needed money, I needed to feed my habit. My parents own a bunch of farms, they got all this junk metal. Little things that mean nothing to them, but to me, I look and see dollar signs. I like this thing right here, it ain't worth much. You probably get $100 for it, and it'd take you a day's work to cut it up and everything, so it really ain't worth it. But you got $100 in your pocket, you can get high for a day, and then...
My husband had just bought a roll of copper wire, and he noticed the copper wire was gone. But it wasn't Dustin. It wasn't Dustin doing this.
Well, when I took the copper, right where that shed is right there, and it was sitting in there, a roll of it, a piece of junk metal, 100 pounds of it would be $5, $10 or whatever. And copper, 100 pounds of it, would be 200 or better.
My husband has this thing with tools. If he sees a good deal on a tool, he'll buy it, and we'd stick it in storage, stick it in the attic until needed. And he needed something one day, and the tools were gone. There was about $20,000 worth of tools.
Now, it's not about family, it's not about friends, it's not about anybody, but my habit, you know.
I'll tell you, the addicts are the best liars you'll ever meet in your life. No matter what I asked him, he always made me believe him, even though deep down inside of my heart, I knew it wasn't true. But he always made me believe him, because you're looking in that little boy's eyes, that's still your little boy.
That's a really powerful clip, Bess, and a wonderful piece of documentary filmmaking, because for us that work in the substance abuse treatment field, we see that dynamic so often. And, you know, when she says it wasn't Dustin doing this, we've heard that so much from parents, and that they want to believe, you know, she says you're looking in that little boy's eyes and that's still your little boy, and you want to believe it. And I just thought you captured that wonderfully, that dynamic of, yeah, and cut that together beautifully.
Thank you.
So, yeah, I mean, I also think that you also caught the denial that the parents, they so want to believe it, and we see it all the time, but also when they finally got confronted with it, she was not mad at him. She was heartbroken, but she wasn't angry at him. She still realized that the kid she loved was in there somewhere, and all he needed to do was get better. And I just thought that was really beautiful, too.
Well, actually, I in the film, she actually does say that it got so bad that she actually, I don't know if you remember
that. Oh, yes, she lost her. I mean, but look at how guilty she felt for losing her temper at him.
Right, but that she went down there and she just said, you know, you're a junkie. I can't take it anymore. And, you know, I mean, the point is we also know that about parents, right, which is that, you know, you give your kid one chance, two chances, 10 chances. You try to get them help. They don't stay in the treatment, or they say they're going to get help and they don't, or you believe that they're doing it on their own and they say they're clean and they're not clean. And, you know, this goes on and on and on. And she just lost it. You know, she got to a place where she just couldn't take it anymore. It was so stressful. And she just said, you know, get out of here. I can't deal with this. And then you see her regret many years later about how she spoke to her son.
But then
she realizes that it's not Dustin, it's
right,
the addiction. And finally, luckily, he did get help and he did get better. And now he's 5 years clean. And I mean, Dustin is amazing right now. He's 5 years clean. He's married. He's about to have a kid. He runs the farm now. He was at the press conference with us at the governor's speech.
Really?
He spoke at the press conference. He's been on all kinds of national stuff. I mean, because when this happened with the governor, all of a sudden everything blew up and we were getting phone calls from ABC and the New York Times and people in Norway and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And, you know, Dustin, along with a number of other people in the movie, have just stepped up to the plate and been such a great ambassador for the film and for this kind of work. So Dustin is a complete success story. But I also have to say, as you also know, that one of the reasons that he is a success story is because he has a really strong family
right
by him. He has a job. He had a wonderful woman who he was engaged to, who totally supported him. He had a truck. He had money in his pocket, and he had a, you know, he had a very tight community that stood with him. And he had Fred Holmes. But, you know, there are a number of people that you see in the film, homeless kids and other people who really don't have a family. And it's clear that we don't know what's going to end up happening with them. And I think that that is such a huge thing. And the governor said that when you interviewed him, which is that addiction, if you're going to really help people, they need a huge support system around them. They need jobs. They need housing. They need family. They need wraparound services. They need a lot of support, because if they don't get that, it's really easy to get depressed and feeling alone and abandoned, and why not do drugs again?
Well, Dr. Holmes, at some points in the film, you could feel his hope, but at other points, you could just feel his, like, you know, I can keep them from using drugs, but I can't get them a job. I can't find them a house. I can't,
The young man, the really young man who was homeless, and, it, you know, he just says, you know, that what's he got to shoot for? You know, and you could see the weariness in his eyes that he was addressing that. And it speaks to a larger problem, you know, and I think the people from the Howard Center said it as well, is that you can't just have one, you know, one little facet of treatment in there and expect everything to fall into place. It's a part of a bigger picture. And it's, you know, in a place like St. Albans, Vermont, where there's, it seems like there's quite a bit of poverty and kind of institutionalized
misery.
There, you know, that there really isn't a lot of carrots at the end of a stick for a lot of these addicts.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's what we hope the governor is going to start pushing in this state, and this should be happening all over the country. We need more resources. We need more money. We need more doctors. We need more therapists. We need more jobs, housing. I mean, this is a huge issue, and it's systemic, going right back to the family. We need a lot more prevention. We need prevention for families. I mean, it's a huge, huge issue. And there are so many different social issues that connect with addiction, like homelessness, like addiction, like domestic violence, like dropping out of school. I mean, these all intersect and create, you know, a bigger problem.
Right. So, I thought you did a beautiful job, and both you and the governor talked about the role of law enforcement. That, I mean, and you interviewed law enforcement and said, what do you think? And, you know, we've had people on both sides on this radio show. But the idea that the money is being spent on keeping people in jails rather than treatment, I thought both you and both the movie and the governor did a great job. How was it hard to get the police to talk about it?
No, not at all. I mean, I think that, the other thing that I think is really important, and the governor touched on this, is that what Vermont has done, and specifically for this movie, what this community of St. Albans did, is they were brave enough to say, fine, come into my community and tell this story. There are plenty of people out there who would say, I don't want my dirty laundry aired. This isn't going to be good for St. Albans. Nobody's going to walk the streets. Nobody's going to come here. But the mayor, who says a few words at the beginning of the film, the police chief, many other community people that I interviewed that didn't get into the movie, you know, there was a lot of support around making this movie. I'm sure there were people who weren't thrilled about it. But the fact of the matter is that this, speaking out about this has brought nothing but good things to the St. Albans, Franklin County area.
Oh, really? That's great.
Well, I think that it has opened up the issue, and it has, I mean, they have a lot of progressive people there who are looking at addiction as, let's not put it, you know, shove it under the carpet. Let's talk about it, and how can we make it better?
So and kind of addressing the stigma.
That's right, addressing the stigma. And I think that, you know, we had the premiere of the film in St. Albans. 500 people came. We had a waiting, you know, we had people lining around the block to get in. There were probably 100 people who weren't even able to come see the movie that night. I mean, this was a community event. This was like going to your high school musical. I mean, this was the thing that everybody wanted to see. And they were seeing their friends, their family, the person at the local store, their cousins, folks that they may not have even known were at one time addicted, who they bump into off the street or at the diner. And then we toured, of course, the film extensively all across the state for 7 weeks. And, you know, it didn't matter which town we went to, whether it was upper class or lower class or this side of the track or that side of the track. There were people coming to these screenings, many parents, for instance, who were just bleary-eyed and, you know, shell-shocked by the fact that their kids were addicted to opiates.
And I think that's the interesting part. It's not... I mean, of course, you said it's set in St. Albans, but it could be any New England town.
Could be any Iowa town.
Absolutely. So I think it's a kind of a wonderful, you know, St. Albans is a stand-in for any town, and it looks at it and personalizes the issue, and we get a real sense of who these people are and what the town is like.
There has to be a belief system that these are not those kids, these are our children. They are not criminals, they are people who get into difficulty because of the nature of their addiction. They are not addicts, they just happen to be children whose illness is addiction.
What recovery and sobriety has given me that I would not have otherwise is the opportunity to really, really face myself and to really learn how to sit with myself.
I can actually feel, like, it's a human experience. I'm experiencing human experiences. It's a beautiful thing.
I cried a river, and I never felt so much better after getting all that shit out of me that I've been hiding behind and stuffing for so many years.
If I didn't feel pain, I wouldn't know how good things are. If I wasn't really angry, I wouldn't really know what happy was. If I didn't suffer, I wouldn't know what hope was.
Welcome back. I'm John Cohan here with Abby Dean. You're listening to Right Turn Radio. That was a clip from Bess O'Brien's documentary film, The Hungry Heart. And we have Bess here on the line talking to us about the film.
So, Bess, the one thing that I wanted you to talk about, the last thing, was tell me about the hope that you've felt in making this movie, because it does come through.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that people in recovery are some of the most amazing people walking the planet. I don't know whether it's that they've hit bottom and come back up. I don't know whether it's because they, especially if they're in AA or the 12-step programs or really focused therapy, they begin to see their life literally one day at a time, which is pretty much of a spiritual high that not very many people are able to get to in their lives. And they begin to truly change their lives around in a way that is just sort of astounding.
Yeah.
And so I really wanted to show that. And the other thing is, I mean, the film is called The Hungry Heart, and that it's there for a reason. I had a hard time finding a title for this movie. It took me months and months and months, and I was driving in my car, and Bruce Springsteen came on, The Hungry Heart, and I said, that's it. And really, that's it for me, in the sense that I think that so much of what, when you talk to addicts who are in the throes of it, so much of what they talk about is taking that first pill to fill a hole,
exactly,
make themselves feel better. And I think that that's at the crux of the matter. And I think that when they get clean and when they come out of that and when they move on with their life, they have such a huge appreciation for the sanctity of life, in the sense that they begin to realize that they can fill that hole up with just the day-to-day beauty of what living in this world is. They also have an amazing ability to realize that pain is all around us and that everyone experiences pain and that it's okay. Because I think one of the things that you hear in the film is, and this goes along with A Hungry Heart, is that a lot of people never felt that they were they never felt good in their own skin, or the pain that they felt in their lives, they felt like they were the only ones experiencing that. And I think one of the things that we need to do is around prevention is to teach young kids right away that, you know, life is not a bowl of cherries, that it's hard, and that that's okay, and that there's ways to get through that, and we have to give people coping skills, we have to give them meditation, we have to give them yoga, we have to give them breathing exercise, we have to give them other things in their life to make them feel like they have a purpose. And we have to say it's okay, because guess what? You know, I also get depressed.
That's
and the lucky ones of us, you know, figure out ways to cope with that depression or that pain or whatever, and we get through our day in different ways. And other people take a pill and it makes them feel awesome. So, you know, I don't know if I answered your question.
You did. I thought it was quite beautiful, actually. Thank you, Bess, and thank you for making this film. And I'm glad Governor Shumlin brought the information out about it. And I'm glad that, you know, everybody in the world should see this thing.
You can check out.
Listen, I have to say something to you guys. First of all, I don't even know much about you guys, but whatever you're doing, it's awesome. I just went on your website. What a cool thing you're doing.
Thank you.
Let's bring the movie to Boston.
We can do that.
Our producer, Jill, will talk to you about that, and we can make that happen. If you're interested in seeing this great documentary, check out the film's website, thehungryheartmovie.org, and we're going to try to bring that to the Boston area. Thanks so much, Bess.
Okay, John and Abby, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
So
wow, so can we sit there and say this is something that only happens in Vermont? No.
And you know, what I was struck by was the universality of the way, you know, they're the same people that we see, the same people that we know that suffer from this disease. But I liked how she took this one doctor, and this is kind of the...
And he's your country doctor.
He's the country. You could see him with the stethoscope walking to, you know, the cabin out in the woods and things like that. He really was that guy. And so it was heartbreaking in this sense, because there were some children in this film, and we got to see...
Yeah, he calls them his youngsters.
Yeah, his youngsters. So it was a powerful film. It wasn't... For me, it was difficult to watch sometimes, and it certainly wasn't the happiest film in the world. But it brings to light this issue, and I think that's probably why the governor of Vermont, you know, made reference to it in his speech.
Well, it's really interesting because whenever I talk to people about addiction, they're all like, "Oh, I hope it's not here." Mm. It's like. It is here. In fact, it's everybody thinks it's them and not us. And through my years of doing this, and I know it's us, it could be anybody. And then you watch this film and she did a beautiful job of saying, this is anybody. This is successful women and, you know, struggling, you know, homeless kids. It's just kind of everyone. They found that description of I took that pill,
yes,
and you know, it was love, it was, you know,
it's the sense of that, you know, we hear that every day. The first one, it filled this hole, I was uncomfortable in my own skin. You can go on and on with that, and why is this a problem now than it wasn't a problem when we were younger, at the level it is a problem now? And it's because prescription opiate abuse has gone way, way up in the last 10, 20 years.
Well, it's really interesting looking at statistics. It's just heartbreaking because it used to be like overdoses was, you know, way at the bottom of, and when I was doing research in public health, kids were having accidents driving, and now right under accidents, it has surpassed for kids.
In Massachusetts, it surpassed
car accidents for the leading cause of death. But for all accidents, for all age groups, it's right below car accidents for the cause of death.
And I like what Governor Shumlin did, which is, you know, framing it in a fiscal thing. Here's how much money we spend incarcerating people with substance abuse addiction. And here's how much money it costs us to send them into treatment. And that is really easy for the average taxpayer to say, gosh, that's a horrible waste of funds, and it doesn't work, by the way. I mean, how many legislatures, police, judicial branch people do we have to hear from to realize that the war on drugs is a
right.
failure?
The CDC, which is just statistics, says things. For every dollar spent on something related to drug addiction, 96 cents goes for the results of the addiction, such as crime or theft or those kind of things, and 4% goes into treatment and prevention. Yeah. And of course, so if we could rearrange how we spent our money, it would make a huge difference.
You've been listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast. Check us out at right-turn.org. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean. Remember, be safe and ask for help.